Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, October 20th, 2016. I don't know about you, but I'm relieved that the presidential debates are finally behind us. An end to America's nightmare is in sight. This free News and Comment podcast is available on YouTube. Spread the word. I hope you will. So we got together last night with friends Patrick and Marion and watched the debate from Las Vegas. And it was interesting. It was also tedious at times and deeply frustrating for somebody like me. And we'll get to fact-checking the fact-checkers here in a moment. But there was a difference. Hillary Clinton was very skillfully attacking and taunting Donald Trump. And he took the bait, as he often does. Now, there are a few times he showed some restraint. She tweaked him about building Trump Tower with undocumented labor, and he managed not to comment on that. But when she said that he's a friend of Putin's and that Putin wants a puppet in the White House, oh, he couldn't control himself. And he went into neener-neener mode and followed up two or three times. I'm not a puppet. You're the puppet. You're the puppet. And it just showed his immaturity, his inability to control himself. And I think that her needling was quite effective. She also kept talking when he tried to interrupt her. She interrupted him a few times more aggressively than she has in the previous debates. And I will say that I was pleasantly surprised that moderator Chris Wallace didn't really show the obvious evidence of the Fox virus that I mentioned yesterday. And he did a better job than the other moderators at keeping Donald in check and under the time limits and trying to, keep them both from talking at the same time. Not always successfully, to be sure, but in ways that I think were better. So what I noticed is how each of the candidates dodged questions. And to his credit, Chris Wallace did follow up a couple of times with Trump, but not so much with Hillary Clinton. And so when she dodged the question about the issues of her foundation receiving contributions from foreign governments while she was Secretary of State in violation of the clear pledge that she and Bill Clinton made, Chris Wallace didn't follow up and press her to answer the question. And I really need to go into detail here about the biggest problem I had with what Clinton said and that was unchallenged and that fact-checkers are just taking in stride. And that is, when asked about the Podesta emails that have recently been released in a series of troves, she didn't respond at all. She shifted the blame to Russia. And she introduced a new talking point. She said that 17 intelligence agencies have confirmed Russian responsibility for these hacks. Now, I haven't seen that fact checked. The New York Times went into detail to prove that Hillary was accurate when she accused Donald Trump of tweeting his sniveling comments that he had failed to win a third Emmy for The Apprentice. But they didn't fact-check her whopper that 17 intelligence agencies confirm Russian responsibility for this hacking. And online this morning, I saw some people saying, what's that based on? And I can only guess that because James Clapper, the man I call the proven perjurer, who still has his job as Director of National Intelligence. Obama should have sacked him years ago. James Clapper is the one who came out on Friday, October 7th, and said that we are confirming that Russia is the source of these hacks. No evidence was offered at that time, and we still have no significant evidence that this is true. And the only way that Clinton can claim these 17 agencies is to infer that because James Clapper is at the top of the organizational chart over the 17 various intelligence agencies in the so-called community, that the inference is that each one of them weighed in and said, oh, yeah, it's Russia, Geospatial Command, yeah, Russia. Cyber Command, yeah, Russia. Defense Intelligence Agency. But we have no proof of this. There is nothing whatsoever that is public to support this new assertion from Hillary Clinton. And the way it was effectively used to dodge the question without any follow-up, other than Trump repeating that you don't know who hacked, I think is astounding. And in the fact-checking in the San Francisco Chronicle today, they pulled a quote from Clinton that followed her 17 intelligence agency claim. It reads, Clinton accused Trump of refusing to acknowledge Russia's attempt to interfere in the election, calling him a puppet of Vladimir Putin. Background, U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that Russia is behind the cyber attacks on the Democratic National Committee, the Clinton campaign, that have led to the WikiLeaks releases of Clinton campaign emails. Trump, in his response, refused to acknowledge what he has been told in intelligence briefings. I don't think we know that, that the attacks are conducted by Russia. And this is rated a true statement by Hillary Clinton. And to me, this is the biggest whopper that the Democrats have launched in this campaign. And when Trump talks about how the media has rigged it and the political establishment has rigged it, he does have a point. But you can't hear any of that in the corporate media, which has really locked arms behind the Clinton candidacy. When it comes to the foundation, she just shifted the topic to the Trump Foundation, which is a mess, but it's a minor mess. It doesn't have the levels of political influence peddling and conflicts of interest that the Clinton Foundation has because of its size and its scope. And there are problems with lawbreaking by the Trump Foundation, but they don't involve donations from Saudi Arabia, for God's sake. Now, I titled today's podcast, Trump Keeps Sniffling as Americans Exhale. And in the subhead, I note that Trump was both sniffling and sniveling. And just to be accurate, I looked up the definition of snivel. And snivel means to cry and sniffle, or to complain in a whining or tearful way. Now, Trump was sniveling, there's no question about that, and Trump was also sniffling again. In every debate, he has exhibited the symptoms of a cocaine user. I don't have any proof of this. I'm like others who have speculated about this, from Howard Dean to Carrie Fisher. And my friend Patrick seemed offended. When I counted the sniffles, I kind of stopped after a dozen. And he said, Peter, you know, I think Trump's a lowlife and has no interest in him or affection for him. But he thinks it's a low blow to suggest that Trump is using cocaine. And to me, what was most telling is in one of his power moments when he was talking about how we need to stop drugs, including heroin, from coming over the Mexican border. He gave a big sniffle right in the middle of it. Then went on to use his line, which has attracted a lot of attention, about some bad hombres. And that, of course, feeds the racist sensibility of many of his supporters that our immigration problems are all caused by brown people at the southern border. So I thought that was an interesting moment. And I take exception with the consensus coverage of the corporate media that the big takeaway from the debate was that Trump is saying that he will not commit to accepting the outcome of the November 8th election. He modified that today by saying he will accept it if he wins. And I think this is a pretty trivial matter, but the media is stoking this to feed the perception that Trump is this kind of anarchist who is going to lead a revolution of NRA supporters if Clinton is elected president. And while I wouldn't rule that out, I think it's highly unlikely. And I think that after Trump presumably loses, he's going to lick his wounds. He'll make noises about this TV network until he finds out how much it would cost and how little people trust him. And so my take on this is that There is a concerted effort by the corporate media to close ranks around Clinton to protect her from damaging questions about the emails, about Bill's sexual misadventures in the past, about Hillary's role in squelching the complaints that came from women who say they were in some way abused by Bill Clinton. And so all of this is pushed off the table to allow the takedown of Trump and this unproven, and as you know, I'm highly skeptical, notion that Russia is trying to manipulate our election. So I am relieved that this is over. Let me run through a couple of the other items that were discussed here, including abortion issues. I give Hillary Clinton high marks for a very clear position in supporting a woman's right to choose. She didn't flinch when the late-term partial birth abortion claims were raised by Trump and his gruesome and inaccurate claims that if you go with what Hillary is saying, in the ninth month, you can take the baby and rip the baby out of the womb of the mother even a day or two before it is expected to be born. I mean, this is utter fabrication. This is the sick mythology of the so-called pro-life movement in this country. And while Trump panders to those people, sometimes pretty effectively, I again give Clinton high marks for standing her ground and not going into weasel words about abortion rights. Also, other topics that came up, I mentioned the undocumented labor, and even Chris Wallace quoted from a paid Clinton speech about Hillary's comments about open trade and open borders, which Trump tried to seize on but kind of mangled his quotation. And Hillary was permitted to say that her open borders and open trade comments were limited to energy, not to the transit of humans. So there were other issues raised. I mentioned the Clinton Foundation and also the dodge on the questions raised about the email server and the recent hacks that have been revealed. And one thing that we're learning is that Russia is apparently in no way involved with the NSA contractor, Harold Martin, who was arrested at the end of August and has been in custody since then. He, of course, was a contractor who, we're told now, took all kinds of stuff home from work, which violates the protocols of the NSA, and he also worked at the Pentagon, where the same secrecy rules applied. But now the investigators are pursuing a line of inquiry that Mr. Martin was trying to sell NSA hacking tools on the Internet, and that he may have been either linked to or the a creator of this anonymous group that called itself the Shadow Brokers. The Shadow Brokers claim they found these hacking tools used by the NSA and that they were tweaking the NSA by promising to put them up on eBay or somewhere in an auction. And of course, all of this was initially blamed on Russia. But now it appears that Mr. Martin has financial problems and may have done this simply for money. Now, what's also included in the New York Times coverage here, when they describe that the FBI found at his home many terabytes of information that would make it by far the largest unauthorized leak of classified material from the classified sector. And they claim that it dwarfs the hundreds of thousands of NSA documents taken by Edward Snowden and exceeds even the more voluminous Panama Papers released earlier this year. Or I guess it was at the end of last year. So this, again, tries to cement the myth that Ed Snowden took hundreds of thousands of NSA documents when the true number is not known. And Glenn Greenwald and others who have had access to the Snowden cache say that the numbers are highly inflated by the government. So, again, this case of Martin is certainly in progress. I have reached no conclusions about this. But that we have the New York Times reporting on leaks from the FBI and other investigators that Russia is nowhere in the radar on this case It's just another example of how we have been misled about this purported role of Russia in recent hacking events and an effort to undermine the November election. And I just find it amazing that the corporate media has just taken this this whole cloth that has been created and now just treats it as real. Here is another tidbit from the leaks of John Podesta's emails, which show that Hillary Clinton, in response to a question about why she voted for that really bad bankruptcy bill back in about 2003, responded when she was under pressure by saying that her vote was part of a process of strengthening the bill for women and children. I faced a tough decision and I stood up for women and children. I was deluged by women's groups and children's advocate groups to do everything I could to make sure that child support and women's precarious financial situation in case of a divorce or not being able to get the kind of funding they needed from a partner or spouse in bankruptcy would not be endangered. So I did go to work on behalf of all these women's groups and children's groups because they needed a champion, and I got that bill changed. Well, the only problem is her crack staff discovered that this isn't true, that all of the groups that she claimed she was going to bat for were opposed to this bankruptcy bill, and strongly, the word ferociously opposed is used to describe their position. So they put Ann O'Leary, one of the staff members, on the case. She tries to do a little damage control. She sends an email. We have a problem. Hillary overstated her case this morning in a pretty big way. Marsha, Judy, and I have been figuring out what we could say that doesn't contradict their 2001 statement referring to the groups that had attacked the bill at the time. She said women's groups were all pressuring her to vote for it. Evidence does not support that statement. Isn't that a nice way of saying that she lied? The evidence doesn't support that statement. So then they keep working on it later in the day. Ann O'Leary sends an update explaining that she'd reached out to the chiefs of staff of Democratic Senators Patty Murray, Barbara Mikulski, and Barbara Boxer to try to paper over Clinton's problem here. And the political operators, the chiefs of staff, said, well, wait a minute. We don't think Senator Mikulski is going to go along with this. So then they also went to these women's and children's groups to see if they could get them to fib to back up Hillary. And by the end of the day, Mandy Grunwald, another communications advisor to the Clinton campaign, just said, well, I just talked to the chief of staff for Elizabeth Warren. She's worried that statements from Mikulski and Murray may be salt in the wound. She is quite angry. And then she says, I can fill you in, but I don't want to write it down here. So that's just another example of how the Clinton campaign plays fast and loose with the truth, uses spin and false testimony to try to back up what appears to be a mistake that was made by the candidate as she was desperately trying to wriggle out of responsibility for a bad vote on a bad bankruptcy law. And now here comes an officer in the Marine Corps, Jason Bresler. He is locked in a legal battle because he turned himself in. He said, yes, I sent classified information over an unsecure link to soldiers in Afghanistan. And this goes back a couple of years. What Bresler did was get information using his classification clearance. And what he saw alarmed him. He wanted to warn fellow Marines in southern Afghanistan about a potentially corrupt Afghan police chief. And just 17 days later, a servant of that police chief killed three Marines and severely wounded a fourth. This is in 2012. And so this soldier fell on his sword and said, yep, I did that. But the military is not being flexible. They're not responding to the details of this situation. They're treating it as a black and white, hey, he's admitted he mishandled classified information. And so now Bresler is demanding the same treatment that Hillary Clinton has received. An attorney for Bresler said he intends to cite the treatment of Clinton as one of the many and most egregious examples of how severely Bresler was punished. So I think that's a very interesting comparative look, and it underscores that Hillary Clinton has gotten away with things here. And James Comey, the FBI director, is the principal enabler of the way that she was able to do this. I want to cite here a fascinating email I got this morning from John LaFrancois. He is a listener who is based in Sacramento here in California, and he has been digging through the FBI's notes, the investigation notes from the Clinton email investigation. And it was Jason Leopold of Vice News who won the release of these documents once the investigation was officially closed. So on page 22 of this FBI document, there are several intriguing mentions here. Let me quote this. In addition to the personal accounts of Abedin, that's Huma Abedin, Mills, Cheryl Mills, Sullivan, Jake Sullivan, and Obama, presumably Barack, not Michelle, seven classified email chains were initially drafted in or sent from the private email accounts of five non-State Department individuals. In the next line, personal email accounts of Abedin, Mills, Sullivan, and Obama appeared in the to, from, or CC line of the email. Now, what John's hawkish investigation here, and I'm talking about his hawkish eyes, not his propensity to support war, but like a hawk, he identified these, and it raises an important question. Did President Obama have a secret email account? And is that a reason why James Comey said, well, I can't indict the president, so I can't indict Hillary either? Now, as John notes, this is purely speculative, and I underscore that. But it does raise a very fascinating question. We know that Obama was addicted to his BlackBerry, and he publicly talked about how tough it was to give that up when he became president, and they set up some kind of a secret workaround so he could use his BlackBerry maybe just to talk to family and friends. I don't really know because, well, it's secret. And in a second, we will talk about some of the other secrets generated under the Obama presidency. But first, like I do every day, I want to pause and thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions, including Susan Lundgren, Faith Peoples, who has multiple subscriptions, Linda Lewis, a stalwart listener and supporter, and Gary Batterson, too. Thanks to you, I can keep this podcast going and pay the bills, and I invite others to step up and help out. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then you click on Become a Subscriber. You get to the sign-up page. We've got bonus books displayed and all the descriptions of how it works. So please, join in and become a part of this community. I mentioned the secret decisions that have occurred and the secret law that has been developed while Barack Obama has been president. And the American Civil Liberties Union is challenging the controversial Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, acronym FISA. And they are demanding, based on the First Amendment, the release of numerous classified decisions of the last 15 years that have established the legal foundation for expanding the government's surveillance activities. Citing Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat, that the classified rulings amount to a body of secret law that discard congressionally enacted privacy restrictions and create essentially a deep state or a shadow government. That's my language, not Ron Wyden's. Well, the Freedom Act of 2015 did require the FISA court to release what are called novel interpretations of the law, but routine interpretations of the law, as determined by the secret FISA court, are permitted to remain secret, it appears. So I applaud the ACLU for demanding this information. They're trying to get the order that was recently revealed where Yahoo was forced to comply with a government order to serve up, to cough up information on millions of users and allow essentially the constant monitoring of Yahoo email. That's a very serious and novel interpretation of law, I would submit, and I think it meets the definition of the USA Freedom Act of 2015. And as a companion piece, I'm linking to this opinion op-ed that was written and published in today's New York Times by Elizabeth Goitein. And she is at the Brennan Center on the Law at New York University. She's co-director of the Justice, Liberty, and National Security Program. And she authored a new report about secret law. And it's fascinating to see how she enumerates what has occurred. This new study shows that these secret laws are frequently withheld from the public. Intelligence agencies routinely issue rules and regulations without publishing them in the Federal Register as required, exploiting what are intended to be narrow exceptions to the requirement. Most presidential directives addressing national security policy are not made public. And documents released by the State Department in litigation reveal that 42% of binding agreements between the U.S. and other countries are unpublished. So when you hear Peter Dale Scott and others describe the deep state, this is the enabling framework for the deep state. The Goitein goes on, secret law persists even in areas where we thought the secrecy had ended. Although Obama's credited for releasing controversial memos written by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel under the Bush administration, the infamous torture memos included, new data show that at least 74 OLC opinions from 2002 to 2009, including intelligence gathering, detention, interrogation of suspected terrorists, remain classified. Similarly, despite the disclosure of many FISA court opinions by Ed Snowden, new information from the Justice Department indicates that about 30 significant opinions remain secret. And theoretically, Congress should be overseeing this and protecting our interests, but we know that's not happening. Obama has announced at least one of his plans for post-presidency activities. He says that he's going to team up with Eric Holder, who was his long-running attorney general, to combat Republican gerrymandering at the state level across this country. Now, in general, I support this. I would rather see Obama work to unravel the secret law, close Guantanamo, expose the surveillance that he has authorized. But I do agree that fixing gerrymandering is an important task. And he and the Democrats failed to do it in the last cycle. They were so exuberant of taking the White House and the Congress in 2009 that they didn't get involved in the races to pack the state legislatures and governor's houses with Republicans. And there are over 30 states that are all red. And those states have produced congressional maps based on the 2010 census that largely favor Republicans. In some states, it's really egregious, and that's the reason why we can't expect Nancy Pelosi to retake the speakership after the November election. They need more than 30 seats to do that, and gerrymandering protects enough Republicans that that is, in my view, highly unlikely. Now, if Obama advocates for citizen redistricting commissions like the one we adopted in California, I will support his work. If he tries to shift gerrymandering into control of Democrats who then use it in an abusive and unfair way against Republicans, then I'm not so thrilled with the idea. And finally today, there are new data that show sharp increases in sexually transmitted diseases here in the United States. The syphilis rate nationally is up by 19%. Chlamydia rates are jumping, particularly among the age group 15 to 24, who comprised nearly two-thirds of the chlamydia diagnoses last year, and the overall rate has increased by 6%. Chlamydia is now reported to be producing 1.5 million cases a year. But syphilis among women has grown by 27%, and the rate of congenital syphilis, which has passed from a pregnant woman to a baby, has risen by 6%. Now, the most obvious cause of this is the Republican-led state governments that have either curbed or shut down Planned Parenthood clinics. And I'd like to believe that, and I think that is a factor. But how do I explain, then, how syphilis cases jumped by 28% here in California, where there have been no Planned Parenthood cutbacks or closures. We'll continue to look into this. And use protection, will you? If you're having fun sexually these days. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment podcast. It's free every day at peterbcollins.com and at YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.